The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
We'll be covering the first 7 days of what appears to be Christ beginning his ministry. And we see here that there were three witnesses to point to Jesus' messiahship and him being the one that fulfilled the prophecy, he being the one that is the promised Messiah. And of course the first witness was John the Baptist, and then the second witness we discussed was those people who believed on him, his followers. And then the third witness is going to be Jesus Christ's first miracle. I really hope that you'll get something good from this study tonight, because you know, you can look at a person and you can see there's a phase of psychology called constitutional psychology that as you look at a person, you can see their features reflect how they think and how they are. And we discussed this when we started the book of John. And then, you know, you could also read someone's signature and you can tell what they're like. And I think you could follow a person around and see what kind of work they did all day. And you could basically tell what their personality is like. That we leave our signature, basically, our mark on everything we say and do in life. And I think this first miracle performed by Jesus Christ is a good example. We can look at this and we can really get some fascinating insight into the mind of Jesus Christ. So, anyway, we're going to see this first miracle that takes place at a wedding. Let's go over to John 2 and start in verse 1. There it says, "In the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there." Now it says that this was the third day, but if you remember when we were going along in the prior accounts, it talked about a first day, and it talked about a second day and so on. In John 1 and verse 43 over here, the day following, it says here. Then in verse 35, it says again the next day after John stood up. And then in verse 29, it says the next day John sees Jesus. So you can see what's happening here. Is there? It couldn't really be the third day. So I think what he's talking about here is the third day after their journey when they went to this wedding. And so that's worth noting there so that we keep the timing right. So the first three or four days took place in Bethabara, and that was in Judea close to the emptying of the Jordan there, a shallow area of the Jordan River above the Dead Sea. And Cana was about a three-day journey north from this Bethabara. And so it's probably the seventh day, the third day of a journey. Now there's another place called Cana where up in Ephraim, but this is not what this is referring to. This is a different little city here. Anyway, the word Cana means reed. Eusebius identified this city in history, and he said that people who had gone there could actually see Nazareth from it. It's about 8 or 9 miles from Nazareth, and it's now called Kirjat Cana, Q, with a Q-A-N-A. And it's noted for its marshes and reeds, and I think that's why the term, you know, reed or Cana. And today there's only about 300 people living there, and probably one of the most noted things about this place was that Josephus was actually captured in this very city by the Romans. It's only mentioned three times in Scripture. Twice it's associated with miracles, this one of the wine, another one where Christ heals a nobleman, but it's also the city where Nathanael came from, if you remember that. So anyway, they arrived, Christ did and his disciples, about the third day here, and the wedding was probably already in progress when they got there. And I say that for two reasons. One is because the weddings they had in that day were far different from the weddings we have today. We have a little ceremony, maybe a dinner and dance, and then everybody flees the area and they go on a honeymoon and leave. But their marriages in those days were sometimes a week long. event. They were fairly considerable in their length and breadth and scope and so on. The word for the marriage is gamos in the Greek, and it refers to a marriage festival. It wasn't just a ceremony, but a huge festival, and there was much preparation. If you pop over to Matthew 22, there's an example here, Matthew 22, of how the weddings were in those days. Matthew 22, verse 2. The kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son, and he sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to the wedding, and they would not come. And again he sent forth other servants, saying, tell them which were bidden, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fatling are killed, and all things are ready, come to the marriage. And so you get the impression of the kind of preparations here that are made for a wedding in that day. And you also notice that it says, come you that were bidden. And so what they did was they would send out a messenger, and the messenger would go and call people to the wedding. And they would then know that they were going to be called to the wedding, but didn't know exactly when it was. So then the individual would go make all the preparations. Finally, there would be a call. It's all ready. Come to the wedding. And so you see the point I make in all of this is that their ceremonies much more closely figured or symbolized the kind of marriage we're going to have in the marriage supper, where ours today do not. So they basically would start the weddings in the middle of the week, and there were generally two parts. They would have this huge feast that would begin in the beginning of it, and then with a great supper and a lot of eating and all that. And then later afterwards, they would have a formal ceremony where a rabbi would actually marry the couple that were there. But then after the ceremony, the couple would be conducted to their new home, and they would be actually carried through the entire city with a canopy held over them, and there would be a torchlight procession that would go through the city, and they would take the longest route possible in order to draw attention to the couple, and also to, so that the people could come out and congratulate and cheer as they went by and that kind of thing, as they took them to their back to their home. And then what they did was they stayed at home for an entire week, and there they had a festival in which they partied and celebrated and so on. They kept a sort of open house. Now it's said by one commentator that they actually, the husband and wife would wear crowns during this 1 week where they were celebrating their marriage, and they would then be treated as kings and queens for that entire week, and they were addressed often as king and queen, and their word was treated as law. But again, you kind of see a parallel, don't you, with what they did. And when Christ talks about virgins and he talks about being called to the marriage, you get an idea that there's a parallel between their ceremony and that we're going to experience. So in those days, people would actually shut down their businesses during that week. They would go visit the couple, and they would give them their best regards and maybe spend a day or even two, and then just go back to their business. And it was a very sort of open kind of affair. But I want us to think for a minute how those marriages fit ours. That is, I think that when we are raised finally to marry Jesus Christ, it's going to be a massive celebration of great rejoicing. And there, of course, it talks about being called to the wedding supper. And so you can see that this whole event is going to be preceded by a grand feast in which we'll eat and drink at Christ's table, and then finally have a marriage ceremony, and there we'll be crowned as kings and queens, and we'll be able to have authority placed on us. And also, I believe during that time that you'll see that, like in their day, where people would come, stop their business, and come to visit, that I can picture very easily the angelic host coming to visit, that, may Gabriel, Michael, some of the angels that we've seen of only in the pages of the Bible will become familiar with, and they'll come and congratulate us all, and we'll be able to meet them as well as others, heroes of faith down through the ages. So it also says in this verse we just read that Jesus' mother was there. And I think that this has some significance. And it tells us this. There's no mention of Joseph, is there? So that indicates to me that Joseph had long ago probably died, and that she was now alone. But one of the reasons I bring this up is because I want you to think about Jesus Christ in this regard for a moment. It says that he was tempted in all points like we are. And so you can see this, at least, that here was Christ. He had to actually be the one that supported the family. He had to be the wage earner for a period of time, didn't he? He had to be the one that had to pay the bills. He had to do everything and worry about all the things that you and I would have to worry about. And he'd have to have acted as the father in the family. He would have had to have run the business. He would have had to have kept the peace in the family and led the others and guided them at home and been the right example and so on. But you understand my point is that when it says he was tempted in all points like we are, I really think that he had to just about fit every individual's circumstance to one degree or another. So that was one part of it here that he did, I think, in that way. Now, there's a tradition why it says the mother was noted here. And the tradition is this, that there's called a monarchian prefaces to the New Testament that were found in Europe. And these chronicles suggest that the one who was getting married here was actually John himself, who wrote this book. And you notice how when he writes, he speaks of himself in the third person. He always minimizes himself and so on. Anyway, it says this, that John's mother was Salome, the sister of Mary, and it says that the bridegroom was the Apostle John in the sense that it says, how does it say this? Mary was the sister to the bridegroom's mother. That's the quote. It's a marginal reference in a Coptic work. So the point I make is this. Think about this. Mary seems to be the one who's responsible here for making sure everything's taken care of. And so it's very likely that there was an association with a family member, at least, in this. So at least it would fit that. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I just thought I'd bring it out. Now, let's go to verse 2 for a minute. It says, both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And so Jesus was called. He was invited to the marriage. And his disciples were also called. And I remind us that you and I are called to the marriage as well. That's the marriage supper that's coming. Now, when it says his disciples were called to the marriage, some people think that, at least if you read some commentaries, they'll act as though they think Christ was called and that his disciples came along. And I don't think so. I think that the disciples, I think what this is saying is the disciples were also called. Now, if Salome's son were getting married, and if it were John, his friends Peter and Andrew would also be called. James would automatically be called to the wedding. Christ would be there because his mother was there and so on. But it does kind of fit in this case that the disciples, you remember this, that he had just called some of these, just called them into service here a couple of days before. And so there must have been a relationship. These people knew each other. They were close. And I think there's some reason to think that it's possible it was John's from some of this. It's just more evidence. But at least it was a closer-knit group than many people think. And it gives some more credibility, I think, to the tradition that it was John's wedding. And at least we know this. The Apostle John was there personally because he witnessed all of this. He was privy to every bit of it. So anyway, the point I want to make today is that we are called to the wedding before we were actually called to become disciples, much like they were. They were called to be disciples, but yet they weren't called into service. And you and I were called from before the foundation of the world to a wedding supper. And we were called actually before we even knew there was going to be a wedding supper. And we are first bidden We're told that a wedding supper is going to take place, and then you and I are going to eventually be called to that wedding when Christ returns. But right now, we're on the wedding list. We are on the wedding list. So anyway, let me go to another point. The issue of the wine comes up in verse 3. And it says, when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, they have no wine. And this is interesting to me. Again, you see here that she is a primary player in the wedding. She's the one responsible for making sure things are taken care of. And then it says, when they wanted wine, it meant that there was a lack, a failing of the wine. So they probably ran out of wine is what it's talking about here. So it could have been poor planning, or it could have just been finances. But she says they have no wine. Now, the governor of the feast didn't know that they had no wine yet. But Mary did, and she was turning to Christ for help. So, again, there are some commentaries that say that they think that Jesus was being asked to perhaps go buy some, or she was asking in a sort of desperation, I don't know what to do. But I really don't think any of this is the case. I think she turned to Jesus Christ to get some wine because she knew that he could work miracles. I think that she turned to him because when she didn't know what to do, he was the head of the family and so on. But I say this, 30 years she saw his character. 30 years she saw how he handled himself in every kind of conceivable instance. She remembered being in the temple. She remembered how at 12 years old he was teaching the doctors of the law. She understood that there had to have been these insights, you understand what I'm getting at, along his life, that the angel speaks to her. You know, the prophets speak, and then miracles are taking place like him with the doctors of the law. Things are different with this man. So I think she understood who he was to a certain degree, and I think she was actually turning to him and asking him for a miracle. So, if you remember this, there was a lot of history here. John, he had left home by now. He was beginning his ministry, and even John the Baptist had declared him to be the Messiah. So I think that what's taking place here is Mary saying, why don't you just go ahead and declare yourself publicly right now? Isn't it time you displayed your power, reveal yourself? I think his response next helps verify this line of thought. Verse 4, Jesus said unto her, woman, what have I to do with you? Mine hour is not yet come. And so he's telling her it's not time yet. So it's like she really knew there would come a time, but it wasn't time yet. Now again, I'll say this. I talked to you earlier on about there was this tremendous amount of irony in the book of John. And this is one of those examples to me. She's saying they have no wine. They need wine. And he's saying, my hour has not yet come. So I think what he's talking about when he says my hour had not yet come, it was his hour to give himself for mankind. And what he's really saying here is, don't worry, I'll make plenty of wine later. You see, it's a reference to understanding that the wine would be a symbol of blood. And so she's saying, we need more wine. And he's going, don't worry, I'm going to make plenty of wine, that is blood later. That is, I'm going to give the blood of my life. Symbolically here he's referring to giving the blood of his life for mankind. Now, when he responds to his mother, don't you think it's a little unusual? I mean, when I read this, I thought he was going like, woman, you know, kind of almost disrespectful. And I wondered about this when I read it, and I thought, well, you know, was he sort of on the edge of breaking the fifth commandment to honor your parents or something? But later, as I looked this up, I found that it was not a rebuke at all, that it was a term often used of respect in their day. Now, Elmer Town writes this on his book on the Gospel of John. He said, actually, the word woman was one of respect and affection rather than a term of abuse, and it was frequently used when any adult addressed a woman. Let's go to John 19. John 19. And I think that helps clarify this, that we are reading back through translations and we're reading through changes from one language to another and so on. 19 and verse 26. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and his disciples standing by, Jesus is now hanging on the cross, and he sees the disciples standing by whom he loved. He said unto his mother, "Woman, behold your son," speaking to John. But you understand, this was said in deepest respect to her, really, because he was now transferring the responsibility of honoring his mother to his beloved disciple John. And so there was this, to me, reeked with respect, and you can understand that term that way. Now, another reason you might think that this was disrespectful is he says this, "What have I to do with you? What is it to me and you?" In other words, he's really saying, what do I have to do with that? And I think that the point he's making here is he's on the verge of beginning this ministry, on the edge, starting it out, that is going to lead to him giving his life for all of mankind. And so here are people that want to feast, they want to eat, drink, and be merry, and yet with no comprehension of what he's all about, and want him to use his power for this kind of an event. And he's saying here, in the context of saving a bride and bridegroom from a little embarrassment. And so now he's saying, what have I got to do with this? I've got a bigger ministry to contend with. But you see, he does, and this is a point I want to make very clearly, he does care about just such a small thing as the embarrassment here. But he makes this to point out the contrast. And again, John writes it so that we understand who he really is and what he's about here. Back to John 2 and verse 5. His mother said unto the servants, "Whatsoever he says unto you, he says to do it." And this word that he uses, "do it," is the active imperative. It means immediately execute whatever he tells you to do. So this to me tells me this. The mother was asking him for a miracle at that time. And she knew the servants might question him. And so she's saying, whatever he does, no matter how funny it may seem to you or out of context, you just do exactly what he says. So she forewarns the servants of this, do whatever he says without question. Now, think for a minute. Jesus Christ is in charge of our lives. We call him Lord, we call him Master, we call him Boss. And we can't see beyond tomorrow, can we? We don't see the future. And so I say this, there's a tremendous example in this, if we could just get it. Whatever he says, just do it. Do it exactly the way he says it. Do it immediately when he says it, without any question. Why? Well, because we don't see the future. We don't know what his purpose is. We don't know why he wants us to go here or go there. But what we do know is it is the right thing to do in every case. You see what I'm getting at? So this is a tremendous example for all of us. She had learned over a lifetime, whatever he says, you just do it. Because why? It's going to work out best for you in every case. So I wish we could see this and follow his admonition to us and just simply give him what he says without question. Because so many of us, because of human nature, we end up giving half-hearted obedience. We sort of do it halfway. We balk at what he says. We question, well, is this really God's will, you know? But how could it be in this situation? Because we think we're going to lose, but we don't see how much we're going to gain later on. So we justify not doing exactly what he says. We excuse ourselves from these kinds of things. And this statement should always ring in our ears. We're to live by every word of God, by every word. And so this example here in John, I think, is a good one for us. Do what he says. It will work out for the best. And there's another point that I think these verses make very clear. And there's always a division of labor. Because Christ could have just miraculously, he could have said, well, go out and look around the corner out by the garage, and there they'd find some wine, couldn't he? But what does he do? He says, get the servants, and the servants go fill the containers with water. and he has a division of labor take place. And there's an example for us in this, and that is that when we want help from God, that he generally will expect us to do a certain part, that there's a division of labor. He does part and we do part in these things. Generally, God will want us to do everything we can do, and then he will help us by doing what we cannot do. And so then in verse 6 it says, there were set six water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing two or three firkins apiece. Now, to me, this is fairly interesting here. You notice the number of the water pots there? There were six, and six is the number of a man. And it's interesting that these were specifically used for the purifying of the Jews. Now, when he says the word Jews, he's not talking just about a race of people. Remember, he generally uses the term Jews for the Jewish religious leadership. And so all of the bureaucracy of the Jews, their religious leadership, they hated Christ. So he gets six firkins that were used for their purification rites. And you remember what they did? They would remember how they said, well, your master eats without washed hands. And what they did was they had these pots of water where people would take and ceremonially clean all the way down to each elbow with this water in this washing ceremony before they would ever eat. And it was the way they showed themselves being important. It was the way they showed themselves of being close to God, of being religious and all of that. And it was a part of their whole religiosity and that whole system there that they had. So the point is they would take this and they would rub their palm and they would work the fingers and then the wrists and then down to the elbow in this ritualistic ceremony. So anyway, six is the number of man, and these water pots were picturing the religious world that was man's, and he chose these six for his first miracle. And I think he did this showing the imperfection, the lack of completeness of their worship, and then he turned the water into wine, picturing again, if you can hear this, the blood of his sacrifice and the perfection of his sacrifice. So the religious leaders required the washing by water to make a person clean. Jesus Christ says his blood makes us clean. And so he used this, I think, very purposefully and symbolically, being his first miracle, to teach us a lesson. It's not by the washing of water, but it is by the washing of his blood. Verse 7, Jesus said unto them, fill the water pots with water, and they filled them to the brim. Let me see. Yeah. Now, the scripture said that each water pot held two or three firkins apiece, and a firkin was a goat skin, and it was used for storing wine. It would measure a certain volume, and anyway, it depended on the flexibility of the skin. And that's why it would say two or three firkins, but the capacity was generally figured to be about 6 to 8 gallons of wine. So if each one held two or three firkins, we're talking about 18 to 24 gallons of wine each. That would be about 120 to 140 gallons of wine for this festival. So again, I would say this, it's a lot of wine. But it's not a lot of wine, because this was a ceremony that was going to go on for an entire week where people from the entire community would come. And so this was going to be enough wine to allow individuals throughout the community to drink for an entire week. So it's again indicative of God's way of life, and that is he is generous, isn't he? He didn't skimp by. He didn't just make enough so that they would just kind of eke by here. But he created a lot of wine. But he didn't really create so much that it was just wasteful spillage, you know. It was a case where he created enough that there was going to be more than enough needed, but it wasn't a superabundance. And so I say this, that this is kind of indicative of the mind of God, that he generally does those things that are practical. He gives you enough. You know, we pray and we don't get every single thing we want, but we are taken care of in our lives. And so it's not a matter of that we're going to be rich and wealthy beyond belief, and we're not going to be poor. And suffering and struggling long, but we will have what is adequate in every case. One of the things that I thought was interesting that one commentary brought out was, you know, why did they say that they filled it to the brim? And I think one of the reasons is because that they wanted to show there wasn't anything else in there but water. But there's another lesson here for us, too, and that is how it is that God rewards us according to our obedience. And so if they filled it half full, they probably would have gotten what? Half of the thing full of wine. And if they filled it all the way full, they got the full amount of wine. And so you understand my point in this, and that is this. If we obey God half-heartedly, what will we get? A half-hearted blessing, you see. But if we obey God fully, to the full, then we can expect and will receive a full blessing from our God. So anyway, the servants filled it right up to the brim, and that's how we should do. When he says for to us that we should do this or that thing, we should do it to the fullest measure. In verse 8, and he said unto them, draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast, and they bore it. So the servants knew that they had put water in these pots. They knew that. And can you imagine the faith here? You have just had water, poured water into these pots, and now the governor of the feast, you're going to draw out and give to him. Would you draw out and give him water? Remember what the mother had said? Whatever he says to do, you do it without questioning it. And so that's what they did. They followed her directions. They thought probably at that point, can you imagine? We're going to be giving this guy water, Joe. And they go to hand him water. But it actually turns out that now they're giving him wine. And so the governor of the feast was titled the chief of the banquet hall with three couches. That's a weird title, isn't it? But it was the title of a person whose duties included bringing the entertainment, arranging the tables and food and all of that. It'd be like a maitre d' today. But his job was like a maitre d', I think, probably does. I don't know, you might give me some insight on this, but his job in those days was to taste the food before it was served to make sure it was appropriate. So he would taste the wine, you see, before it would be served, because it was part of his job as a sort of maitre d'. And that's why they were doing this. But the governor's response is very interesting in verse 9. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and knew not where it came from, but the servants which drew the water, they knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom and said unto him, every man at the beginning does set forth the good wine, and when men have drunk well, then that which is worse. But you have kept the good wine until now. So that's kind of interesting. You see something again about our God and what he is like. So one of the first examples I'd like to bring out is this, is that, you know, people will say in some religious quarters that God doesn't want us to drink any alcohol, that drinking alcohol is evil and bad, it's sin and so on. Well, here's an example. 6 firkins of wine. We've got 140 gallons of wine, and the governor of the feast says what? This is better than at the first. Well, do you think they were just drinking grape juice at the first? Absolutely not. You see, my point is that this is another proof that it's okay to drink. What God doesn't want is for us to be drunkards and so on. So this is a good indicator of that. But there's another thing, and that is this. I believe that there is a principle here that where God saves the best for last. And it isn't totally fitting in this case, but I do believe it's a principle that exists within this, that Christ could have made the wine to be just exactly the same wine as the wine that they drank in the beginning. He could have created it to be slightly inferior. He could have done anything, but what he did was he created very good wine. And I think it's because, as it's said, that others put out the best first and then save the bad stuff for later, or the inferior wine. But he had saved the best for last. And I think that's how it is with God's way. That I think that it's even as you read in Isaiah, where it says the increase of his government, there's no end. I don't think that we start out with a kingdom and then we sort of just drift along and we keep going through the motions. I think that life gets forever better. I think it doesn't just increase in size and scope. It doesn't just increase in quantity, but it increases in quality. And there's always this element of life getting better. It's going to be better and better. The end is always going to be better than the beginning. And I think that's an element of God. And that's why I see us, where we have the first resurrection, is a glorious thing, isn't it? And it's a better resurrection. But look at the size of the second one. The joy and the magnitude of, the brothers and the sisters and the aunts and the uncles and the little babies that mothers thought they lost, and they're going to live again. You see, that's going to be a time of such rejoicing. And then it's capped off with the frosting on the cake. New Jerusalem comes down, and the Father, and the glory and majesty of that event. You understand what I'm saying? And that end is just the beginning. So don't think for a minute God doesn't have a few tricks up his sleeve for life getting better and better and better as it goes on. There's an element to this. But again, there's another point I'd make too, and that is this. When God does anything, it's done with an incredible amount of quality. John 2 and verse 11 says this, "In this beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and he manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him." Here it is, the first miracle that God does. And whenever God does something for the first time, he does it with the intent in mind of demonstrating some important points and principles. Now, when it says this is the first miracle, it's simanio in the Greek, and it means a sign or token, and it means a sign that is pointing us to something. And so this miracle was done to point us to something, and it points us, I believe, in the way that we should live, to live like Christ lives. Here he is beginning to reveal himself as our God, our Messiah, as the Creator. And so this sign tells us who he was, but it tells us how he is, what he's like. That is, it says it was done to manifest his glory. And so you understand this? This little miracle represents him, his way, his nature. And it's there for us to be able to understand him better. And so I put a lot of emphasis on this first miracle. There's a point I'd like to make before we go any further. You know, if you read the apocryphal books, you read a lot of these other books that are out there that are not canon. And some people would say, well, they're, you know, just as legitimate as the Bible and so on. But you know what most of them have? Gospel of Thomas and some of these other gospels and purported gospels. They just have a parade of miracles that Jesus is doing, even as a child. He's doing miracles in some of these gospel accounts. But what does John say? This was the first miracle. So you understand why I'm saying this. I think that it helps discredit those other books that claim to be as reputable as the Bible. So it's at least a point in here. So I want you to think about this. Here's the first miracle he performs. It's not done in Jerusalem, the religious capital of all of Judea. It's not done at the temple, the center of the religious community. And it's not done in front of a great, huge, assembled crowd, is it? It's not a miracle that's huge like the splitting of the Red Sea. Instead, it's done in a tiny little town that, at least in our modern day, has only 300 people living in it. It's a tiny, tiny town, and it's a tiny miracle, isn't it? His first miracle is tiny. But it shows us something that I think is very important. God is with us no matter where we are. We don't have to be the big and important. We don't have to be a part of the grand religious groups and so on for him to care about each one of us. You can live in Pacoima. You can live in East L.A. Or you can live in Orange County where the wealthy are. But God cares about each individual no matter where they are or where they live. And he's willing to work a miracle in your very home, as small as it may be. And his purpose in this was not a grand purpose. It was not to save the world from a catastrophe. It was not to rock the Roman Empire back on its heels. No, it wasn't raising somebody from the dead. All he was doing here is saving a couple from embarrassment. That's all he did in doing this. They probably didn't plan well. Maybe they didn't have enough money or something. But think about this. Remember how he said that the very hairs of our head are numbered? Can you see that in this? Can you see that here's a couple that have a little problem, and he's willing to help solve that problem for them and willing to do this for his mother? Unimportant people, unimportant place, unimportant miracle, but he's willing to help out. Why, that shows us an awful lot about God and about him caring about us. And even the small things. It doesn't have to be a great big crisis, does it, in your life? You can ask God for help in even the small things. I remember I was told once to pray for something. Once we needed a car, we didn't have much money. And I remember that there was this case where I had heard a minister talking about being specific in your prayers. And so I told God, I said, okay, I want a station wagon, and I want it to be stick shift, and I want it to be yellow with black interior. I thought, this is stupid. But you know what happened in the next 2 weeks? I got the whale of a deal on a little, it was a Hornet. You guys remember those Hornets? It was the nicest little car. It was like a Rambler or something in the old days. But this was kind of a very nice car and had black leather interior. It was yellow and it was stick shift and everything I'd asked for. And that car served us for like 140,000 miles before we got rid of it in our family with all the kids. But, you know, the point I make is that he cares about those specifics and was like a witness to me. I'm not saying that he'll do everything that we want, and he's not a magic genie we pull out of our pocket, but in my case of where I was in my life, he showed me, yes, Art, I am there, and I care about all the details in everybody's life. And I think there's evidence of that in here. He cares about our problems, whether they're big or whether they're small. And then when he made the wine, he didn't skip. He didn't skimp on it. He made a lot of wine. And again, it shows us that our God is a God who is generous. Now remember this, he says, give and it'll be given unto you. That's God's way of life. That's how he lives. He is a person that gives to others. And so when they asked for a miracle, he gave them more than they probably would have expected. And that's, I think, the way he is. And that's another example for us. To be people who give to others and not skimpy and say, well, okay, you have needs, so okay, give you this tiny little bit, you know, when you open the purse and the butterflies fly out as the pictures of some of the Scottish people are. But another point is this. He met a genuine need. They had a need, and we have needs sometimes. And so he gave them what it was. It was a practical solution to a real problem. And so this is how God is, practical, pragmatic. And there's a point I'd like to make about this as well. Here was a miracle done at a feast, at a festive occasion. Now, you've seen religious people who act like God only loves the poor, that act like, for instance, the Amish people. They came out of the Calvinistic movement, and they believe that man's nature is depraved and that man is only evil and you shouldn't have anything enjoyable. Why, they believe that you can use a car to do work. They believe in work, but if they buy a car to do a job, they pull all the chrome off, they pull all the decorations off, and they only dress in black. And they think that that's how life is, just serious. It's only serious. But you see, this is not what God is really like, is he? This is a great indicator. Here's God, and remember what they called Christ? A gluttonous man and a wine bibber. But he wasn't a gluttonous man and a wine bibber, but he enjoyed life. There's nothing wrong with having a party, is there? There's nothing wrong with us going to that pool party and really enjoying ourselves. And this is like God puts a stamp of approval on that sort of thing. It's okay to have a drink. Wine was made to make you merry. We shouldn't get drunk and stagger around. We shouldn't be so, you know, we can't get up in the morning and perform our jobs or things like that. But it's an indicator that God isn't like the Amish have him viewed. That God says this. He says that you're at his right hand, pleasures forevermore. Can you see that? Living a life in harmony, peace, and cooperation, and fun, having fun. And that's why at the feast he says rejoice, doesn't he? And that's why we take the kids out, don't we? We have a family day, and they're going to drive the go-karts, and they're going to go down the slides, and they're going to have kid fun, because that's the way God is. And I think it's indicated again here.
Anyway,
it's an indicator of the mind of God. And there's so many people that have the idea that God is somehow an ascetic or something. There was a time when I went to a spokesman's club, the men's club for speaking, that we taught the young men how to speak and so on. And there was a guy in this club that was an official wine taster. And he was a connoisseur of great wines. And I remember that he had a $275 bottle of wine. And this was over a decade and a half ago. So I'm sure it's worth maybe $350 or $400 today, but I had never had that kind of wine before. Anyway, I like wine. I think you drink wine, don't you? And you drink a little bit, don't you? I like a good Cabernet, and there is a difference between a bad Cabernet and a good Cabernet. And I've had, you know, $30 bottles, $40 bottles of wine. And I personally like California wines much better. I once invested in a $75 bottle of wine from France, and I drank it with my boss at Frerich's Engineers. We sat down after work, and we shared this bottle of wine. It was nothing like I think California wines are so much better. There seems to be an acidic kind of vinegary element to some of the French wines. But anyway, this wine, with $275 bottle of wine, we each got a little tiny bit of it. It was the best wine I had ever tasted, where you just put a little bit on your palate and you sort of move it around, and you could just, the aftertaste was so good. And I remember when I drank that wine, I thought about this event, and I thought, man, what did the governor of the feast taste? Because Christ is the creator of good wine. What kind of wine did he make? I bet it was every bit, if not better, than that wine I had for $275 for a bottle. Anyway, this is the way God is, and this is the way he makes a future for us. That you can tell right now when you look at the brilliant galaxies, he creates and what he makes. And you see it everywhere. You look at the human brain. You look at an eyeball, the way it's, the intricacy and the way it performs. And everything he makes is of such quality and beauty. And so the wine is just a reflection of one more time here. But again, it's the example. You see, it's a sign. And a sign is pointing us to something. Here he is. This is how he lives. This is what he does. This is how he thinks. He gives to others. And he gives generously. And he gives quality. And he cares about even the small things in people's lives. Isn't it an incredible thing? It is. One simple, small miracle in a small place with small people, quote unquote. But it shows the mind of our God. And so I remind us that we are to follow his example and to be willing to give to others who are in humble situations, and to be able to give in small ways when necessary, to be generous towards others, to be practical and give what's appropriate and right, and to do unto others, that is, give unto others, without expecting something in return. And also to enjoy every day of life while we have it to enjoy. And that it's good to have fun and laugh and rejoice and do things that are fun and go to movies and have good times. But always to strive in everything we do to produce quality to the very best of our ability. And so his first miracle shows us much about how God is and the way he is, the way he thinks and how he lives. And it shows us his creative power and his purpose for coming down to earth, and the way that we should then live our lives as we follow him.